Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. And I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce tonight Elaine Kmark, on her book, Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again, something that we hope both of the candidates look at. Elaine is a senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at Brookings, and is the founding director of the Center for Effective Public Management. She's also on the faculty of the Harvard Kennedy School of Government and has worked in several American presidential campaigns. Her other books include Primary Politics, and we're here to find out if we can actually find a pattern in why our presidents fail, and if we can, whether they can learn from it, the ones in the future. Thanks a lot for coming, Elaine.
Thank you very much, George. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club for allowing me to come here and talk about this book. This presidents fail for a lot of reasons and a lot of different ways, okay? And we certainly have had some whopping big failures of presidents. James Buchanan was the president when the country went into a civil war. He kind of failed. I mean, that was pretty big failure. We've had other presidents who were in scandals. We've had other presidents who were just mediocrities, et cetera. This is a book about failure that I think is somewhat unique to the 21st century, because it's a book about the relationship between presidents and the very large federal government that they allegedly are in charge of. And as far as I know, that aspect of the presidency hasn't been written about. We've written about the imperial presidency. There's oodles written about president speeches, et cetera. And not much about how they interact with the bureaucracy and how they actually implement policy. And my contention in this book is that because of presidents' distance from the government they run, what's happened to presidents over time is that they've been prone to some really big crash and burn failures. And in the book, I talk about a couple of those failures over time. This is a very bipartisan book because I talk about Democratic failures and Republican failures. I tell the story of the failed Iranian hostage rescue mission in 1980. Under Jimmy Carter. I tell the story of our failure to anticipate 9/11, the Iraq war consequences, and the financial crisis under President Bush. I tell the story of the failure of the rollout of the Obamacare program and the failure to see the scandals at the Veterans Administration under President Obama. All of these have two things in common. The first is that these presidents suffer mightily from these failures. Even though Jimmy Carter didn't fly the helicopters and President Obama didn't write the code for the websites, okay, the failure comes back and hits them. The rest of their agenda suffers because of it. They lose enormous political capital. The second reason these failures are important is that these are failures that are governmental failures that continue to reduce Americans' trust in government. And so after every one of these, Americans say, this government couldn't organize a two-car funeral, which is one of my favorite sayings, and it was also one of Bill Clinton's favorite sayings all the time. So let me unpack a little bit of this for you by reading a passage that I think describes, that sets up this relationship or lack thereof. Whenever America gets a new president and vice president, a team of government workers at the General Services Administration is responsible for taking down the photos of the outgoing president and vice president and putting up photos of the incoming president and vice president, while the rest of the country is digesting election results and slowing down for the holidays. This team is working overtime. They must get official photographs taken of the two new leaders, have them reproduced in the thousands, and then make plans to put them up in 8,603 federal government offices in the United States, approximately 200 embassies and consulates in around the world, and between 500 and 1,000 military installations around the world, depending on how you count them and how much, whether or not we're at war. This is no small undertaking, as the switch must be accomplished in a very short amount of time, just before and just after noon on Inauguration Day. Okay, it all happens at once. The symbolism, of course, is immense. On the day after Inauguration Day, approximately 2.7 million civilians and 1.5 million military personnel who work for Uncle Sam come into their offices. The claims adjuster at the Social Security office in Rochester, New York, the deputy chief of mission in Tirana, Albania, the forest ranger at Yellowstone National Park, the biologist at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, and the soldiers stationed in Stuttgart, Germany, all see the same thing when they arrive: their new boss. They may not have voted for the new boss. In fact, they may hate him, hate his new team, hate his party, but they all know who the boss is. And they have all entered government service knowing that whether they like it or not, they work for the president. Now, let's go over to the White House on that same day. On the morning after the inaugural festivities, a tired and perhaps slightly hungover president and vice president get to work. There are a lot of new people around them who work for them. Most of them, however, are in military uniform. They open the doors, fly the helicopters, and man the watch and the guns that sit on top of the White House. What these employees do not actually do is talk to the president. In fact, on that first morning after the inauguration, the people most likely to talk to the new president are the same ones who have been talking to him for the past 2 years, the close campaign advisors. There will be some new faces. Every morning, the CIA sends over someone with a briefcase handcuffed to his wrist to present the president's daily brief, a compilation of the most sensitive goings-on collected overtly and covertly from around the world by American spies. Some of these spies are undercover and are probably the only federal employees who don't walk into an office the morning after Election Day and see photos of the new president and vice president. But most of the people the president sees every day will be the same people he saw when he was campaigning. The people the president really doesn't know are the 4 million or so people who work for him in the executive branch and the military. A new president is aware intellectually that they are there, but few presidents ever go and walk the halls of the vast buildings in Washington, D.C. and around the country that house the federal government. Republican presidents tend to assume that all of these people hate them and are out to get them. Democratic presidents tend to assume that all of these people love them and are going to do exactly what they want. And what everybody misses is the fact that in an organization this big, at any given point in time, something is going very right and something is going very wrong. And therefore, you can't have a sort of blanket, you know, opinion of the thing. In many of the failures that I go through, the failure was a failure of organizational capacity. And it was knowable. When there are big failures, the failure of the government to respond to Hurricane Katrina, the whole thing tends to get wrapped up in, you know, oh, it was an act of God. Okay, but the fact of the matter is there are multiple warning signs about the ability of organizations to either do something very good or to really screw up badly. And a president actually needs to know that about the government he runs. Let me give you a perfect example of this simultaneity, okay? I'll read another short passage. That'll be my last. On December 21st, 2013, Two Americans, Michael S. Hopkins and Richard A. Mastracchio, detached tubing and electrical connectors from a malfunctioning cooling pump. This may sound very ordinary until you realize that the two Americans were astronauts, and the cooling pump they were fixing was part of the International Space Station, 240 miles above the Earth. During their 5.5-hour spacewalk, they wore suits designed to protect them from the lack of oxygen, the freezing temperatures, and the cosmic dust that makes space an inhospitable place for humans, to say the least. 2 months earlier, on October 1, 2013, millions of Americans in search of subsidized health care insurance logged on to the new federal website, healthcare.gov, hoping to buy insurance as easily as they could buy a plane ticket or a book. Or so they thought. Instead, to the dismay of many Americans shopping for health insurance and to the surprise of President Obama and his top staff, the website crashed. Not once, not twice, but again and again and again over a period of 3 long months. The press erupted in a frenzy over the inability of the federal government to build the website at the heart of President Obama's health care reform. They were joined by a polarized citizenry, half of whom wanted to buy health care and were endlessly frustrated, and half of whom saw the whole episode as yet more evidence that the government couldn't organize a two-car funeral. The pundits pounced, opining that the federal government couldn't do technology, that government was hopelessly broken. And yet no one seemed to notice that the technological marvel of men walking in space to repair a space station was accomplished in exactly the same manner that in which the healthcare.gov website was built. Federal bureaucrats at NASA contracted with a variety of companies in the private sector, from a little-known company in western Massachusetts that makes spacesuits, to Boeing, the aerospace giant that designed and built most of the space station. In another part of the government, the one dealing with health care, federal bureaucrats at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services contracted with information technology companies in the private sector to build the infamous website. The success of the spacewalk passed with little notice, while the failure of healthcare.gov ruined President Obama's Christmas, pushed his approval ratings to new lows, got rid of any hope that he could pass an immigration reform bill, and convinced Americans ready to be convinced that Obama and the government he was in charge of was hopelessly inept. And so that's an example of something going very right, very wrong at the same time, even though the processes and the systems in place were actually the same for both of those. So it brings us to the question of this behemoth, the federal government, and what's going on with it at any given point in time. And I urge you to read the whole book because I obviously am not going to keep everybody here for hours. But let me give you some little hints. When Jimmy Carter sent a rescue mission into the desert outside of Tehran in 1980, he was operating with a military that was incapable of undertaking a joint exercise. In other words, between Army, Navy, Air Force, CIA. Not only was it incapable, there had been 4 decades of high-level commissions saying, wait a minute, our military's broken. It can't do these sort of complicated things. In addition, under President Kennedy, a brief spell of special forces funding had been knocked out by the generals who didn't like this idea of special forces. So here we have lots of warning about joint entities, about joint operations, and a diminution, almost disappearance of special forces, which only come back the year before Carter authorizes the rescue mission, and that's not enough time to make them. And it fails. Now, obviously, there was a dust storm, right? And there was this, and there was that, and there was bad luck, etc. But the bottom line was the U.S. military was in no shape to do this. Quickly after that failure, the U.S. Congress finally stood up to the Pentagon and passed what's known as the Goldwater-Nichols Act in 1986 and really reshaped the way the military interacts among the forces. And all you have to do to see the results of that is compare the rescue mission in 1980 and the special forces who assassinated Osama bin Laden in 2011. And you see a very different military. Going to the Bush administration from the Carter administration, there were many flashing lights in the Bush administration about a variety of failures that they had. But one of them came from a very small group of bureaucrats at the State Department called INR at the State Department. And intelligence nationalization, nationalism resource, I can't remember what the exact thing is, INR, but what they said in their report was, don't invade Iraq. If you invade Iraq, you won't make a democracy. You will, in fact, unleash sectarian forces and tribal forces that have been dormant for under Saddam Hussein, and it's going to spread to the full Middle East and blah, blah, blah. I mean, in other words, way back at the beginning of the 2000s, they were predicting what we've seen happen in the last 16 years. As I was writing this and looking into the background of this small piece of the State Department, some documents came declassified from the Vietnam era. And lo and behold, the fathers or grandfathers of the people who worked in INR under the Bush administration had actually been as prescient about Vietnam. They had issued a report that suddenly, it was only recently declassified, that said, don't do that, okay? Don't go into Vietnam. It will be a disaster, and this will happen. So, again, in the government sits these little pieces of wisdom, okay? They know this government, because it is so big and unwieldy, but it actually knows things. And a president needs to know what it knows. And, of course, the Veterans Administration failure in the Obama administration, which really, you know, was not helpful to Democrats' prospects in the midterm elections in 2014. It was just a major mess, especially as it was discovered that people were dying while they waited for treatment at the VA. That issue was passed on to the Obama administration from the Bush administration in their transition between 2008 and 2009. And yet it just got lost. Okay, just got lost. And lo and behold, if you remember, when Obama, when this happened, Obama sort of was completely surprised, taken aback, and looked like he didn't know what his own government was doing. What I sum up the book as is talking about the essence of leadership, some of which applies to really any leader. Way back a century ago, a leadership theorist named Mary Parker Follett talked about leadership as being holistic, that good leaders really did a lot of very different things. And I broke that down into three simple baskets: policy, communication, and implementation. If you wanted to apply that to the private sector instead of policy, you might say product, communication, implementation. And frankly, good leadership means all three are getting the same amount of attention and talent brought to them. What's happened to modern presidents is they spend a lot of time on communication. I owe a great debt of gratitude to a political scientist named Sam Kernell, who wrote a book called Going Public, in which he just counted presidential speeches and presidential trips, and shows that over the years, these presidents just started talking and talking and traveling more and more with every president. And so if you think of these as three equal circles, the communication circle is huge in the modern presidency. I was in Bill Clinton's White House for 5 years. We would get up in the morning way too early, go to the senior staff meeting, And the first thing anybody talked about was the message of the day. Forget what the government was actually doing. It was the message of the day. And so part of the book is a plea to put these a little bit back in perspective, even for the president. Now, why does this happen? It happens, of course, because the president comes into office having talked. That's what he's done. He has talked. He has talked against wonderful backdrops and big American flags, and he has spent 2 years talking. And every time he gets in trouble, they trot him out to talk. And, you know, this is what they know how to do. They know how to make speeches, they know how to make events, etc. The problem when candidates become presidents is it's reality time. Reality takes over. So doesn't matter how many eloquent speeches Barack Obama could give. They made absolutely no difference when people were trying to get online and buy health insurance and the computers were crashing. Didn't make any difference. You can't talk your way out of these big presidential failures. And that's why they are so damaging to presidents and to the government that we want to work. And so I've made a couple of, you know, sort of incremental suggestions for new presidents. First is literally scheduling, okay? The scheduler is usually in a White House is somebody nobody's ever heard of. It is by far and away the most important person in the White House because it reflects the presidential priorities. And the scheduler needs to be somebody who understands that the president needs time to govern, whether that is talking to people in the House or in the Senate, whether that is talking to agency heads about whether or not this will work or what the problem seems to be over at the Veterans Administration. The president needs time. Secondly, you are, you know, well advised to ask, well, how can any person get a handle on something this big, right? How can they do it? Well, they can. Okay, this is not impossible. A president can decide to devote a sizable portion of his or her White House staff to what I call horizon scanning of the federal government, starting out right from the beginning saying, what's working here? Where are our trouble spots? What are the pieces of the government we're going to rely on to implement things? Give you an example of that. Prior to the president's decision to place Obamacare in the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that agency had been on the government's high-risk list, and the high-risk list is a list of the government agencies with the most problems, for 15 years. It had been right out there, okay? Lots of independent auditors from the Government Accounting Office had written and said, they're in trouble. For many, many reasons, but basically the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services were having a hard time doing the job they already had, which was running the massive Medicare program and the massive Medicaid program. Why would you then give them a new job, right, when they were having trouble with the old job? So that's the kind of thing I mean by horizon scanning. In all of the instances I talk about in the book, and I'm sure there's others that I've missed, the fact of the matter was people knew that the agencies or at certain organizations were in trouble. You know, if you're running a huge conglomerate, a business conglomerate like General Electric, you do have a pretty quick test is whether or not they're in trouble. You can look at their balance sheets and, you know, they're making money or they're not making money. There are no balance sheets in the federal government. There can't, in many parts of it, you just can't even imagine constructing a balance sheet because they don't do things that are easily measurable. But it is possible. People do study them. Members of Congress do some oversight, although not as much as they used to do. It is possible to have a sense of where things are working and where things are not working. And that's the other thing a new president has to do, get a hold of the government he runs. Because the bottom line here is that when a president fails, there is no amount of talking, no amount of messaging, no amount of advertising that gets him out of the mess. To conclude with just a fun joke from the business sector, and you think of product and communication and implementation, I just want to bring you the archetypal example of the dog food. That was a new product of dog food and a great advertising campaign, just the best advertising campaign ever. What was the problem? The dogs didn't eat the dog food. And there we go. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to take questions.
So I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Elaine Kmark speaking about her book, Why Presidents Fail. And she focused very clearly on the relationship between the president and the bureaucracy that he runs. Who would like to ask the first question?
My question is in regards to second terms. Most of our two-term presidents in the last 50 years have ran into either scandal in their second term or bad policy decisions in their second term that has really wrecked their overall rating as presidents. And what's your thoughts on second terms and as far as the issues that have presidents have faced?
Second terms have historically been, as you say, problematic. And I think there's a couple things that happen there. First of all, oftentimes the first-tier team is exhausted, and they've gone on to put their kids through jail, listen to me, put their kids through college, and you know, they wanted to do something else. So I think that happens. I also think, and somebody described this to me after Bush's the first Bush's, Daddy Bush, for 41, after his first term. They said, after one term in office, and not to mention then two terms really prior, you know, of the that he was vice president in, there were so many relationships that it actually kept the relationships, the political relationships, kind of got in the way of making a clear policy. Oh, no, we can't do that because good old Congressman so-and-so, he was our friend, and we can't do that. And then we can't do this, and we can't do that. And so they get sort of tied up in a way that – and lose clarity of purpose. And, of course, there is then just the relaxation of standards without that reelection, you know, looming in front of you. So, of course, in Reagan's second term, he had the Iran-Contra scandal. In Bill Clinton's second term, he had the Monica Lewinsky scandal. So they do kind of lose a little focus. I'm not sure how you can avoid that, but I think Obama actually managed to try to avoid the worst of it. His second term had Obamacare and the VA, and that kind of took his political capital, but he's been remarkably free of actual scandal-type scandals.
This small group in the State Department, INR, I served 8 years in the Reagan administration and 4 years in the senior Bush administration, and I had dealings with the State Department, and I never heard of this group. Why is it they've warned twice of impending problems? Why is it that they have not gained more prominence with presidents?
Well, I don't know the answer. That's a great question. I don't know the answer the first time around. In the Bush administration, they did, first of all, they don't have much prominence because they're mostly spies. Okay, so they mostly are spies and former spies, and they deal with classified information all the time. So their reports are always classified. Somebody asked me at another book talk, what's INR working on now? I said, I don't know. You know, it's all secret. So you don't hear of them, and they don't really want you to hear of them. In the Bush administration, it's clear that they were briefing Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, and Colin Powell was pretty systematically cut out of the action when it came to the run-up to the Iraq War. We've now got enough history of that period to show that Rumsfeld and Cheney essentially built a system that precluded the president from getting some of the information he needed. And that's why that never got into it.
I would like to ask whether, when you look back over history or even recent history, the previous professional experience of the president tends to matter in whether or not they're successful. So, for example, having previously worked in government or having executive management experience, is there anything that tends to be a greater predictor of success or not?
Well, presidents do need to have political skills. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. You know, the great presidents were great politicians because they do operate in a system of shared power, and they have to operate with the Congress and with the Constitution. So clearly political skills, which is why it's iffy to have a businessman who never had any political skills be president. On the other hand, you know, somebody like Mitt Romney, who had significant business skills and was the governor of a fairly large state, and I lived there while he was governor. He was a pretty good governor, too. Somebody like that has a very good combination of skills. A lot of legislators don't have the executive skill, and that's a problem, since Senate also, my dissertation advisor, Nelson Polsby, may he rest in peace. I went to Cal across the bay there. My dissertation advisor used to say of United States senators, they all get up in the morning, and as they're shaving, they say to themselves, "Good morning, Mr. President." So, you know, so they don't always have good executive experience. But then there's some, you know, Evan Bayh and George Voinovich, who were governors and senators. And they have a very good sense of how the government works. They don't always become president, as we've seen. But you can't have no politics. I mean, you just can't have no politics because we don't have dictators. Now, there's a certain person running for president who thinks maybe you can act like a dictator, but the system won't let you.
Can you provide an example, an illustrative example of a major presidential failure of the sort you've discussed that a president was able to recover from, and how he was able to do that, and how? I mean, you kind of implied they don't, but mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could name any examples where they did.
Well, I think Reagan had the Challenger disaster on his watch, and I think he recovered from that pretty well. And I think NASA, after the Challenger disaster, NASA redid a lot of its internal operations in terms of how they dealt with the contractors and how they thought about these big, extraordinarily complex processes. You know, and one of the things that struck me about the 9/11 failure, the failure to see that, was that there was no immediate review of the intelligence agencies. Now, I sort of understand it because the Bush administration's point of view was they didn't know what else was coming, and they didn't want to burden them by doing reorganization when they wanted them to just, you know, up their game and collect more intelligence. On the other hand, it was a massive intelligence failure, and they didn't do the subsequent internal review. So I think that when a president does rebound, it's because they force the agency to look internally, and you know, I think that happens sometimes, but not very often. Because they're just, everybody's so traumatized that they just move on. The Army, interestingly enough, does something called after action reviews. You know, when they play war games, and in the after action review, the soldiers sit around with the generals and say, "You know, you got me killed. right? You did this, you made this movement, and I got killed. Well, I've long advocated after-action reviews for everything, every agency in the federal government. They don't tend to do it.
You mentioned the failure. I mean, the failure for 9/11 didn't seem to hurt George W. Bush.
Well, of course.
The failures later did.
Later did, yes. It didn't seem to hurt him. And, I mean, in fact, it boosted him initially. But remember that as the years went on, he was forced to have a 9/11 commission. Mm-hmm. He was forced to create a Department of Homeland Security. In other words, he got a reaction after the dust settled, because that was a fairly traumatic experience. After the dust settled, people forced Bush to do things that the administration didn't want to do in terms of that. And then he, of course, followed it up with the Iraq War, which did hurt him by 2006.
Yeah. Christmas is coming. And
yes.
My hope is that we will have a Christmas present of three pieces of literature that are given to our new president. One is your book.
Oh,
in the
you.
Same gift wrapping is Moneyball for Government. And the third one is Cass Sunstein's book, Wiser, How to Avoid Groupthink.
Right.
What do you think? If that was done, could you get it there?
I think that's a wonderful idea. And I like Cass Sunstein's book very much, and I love the book Moneyball for Government. The only thing I would say about Moneyball for Government is that and the Obama administration was somewhat guilty of this. There's and all of us here, right? The fascination, the love of computers and data sometimes takes us in the wrong direction. There's you know, if you looked at the data on the VA, you wouldn't know what was happening. Okay? Not only wrong metrics, but when things are really going wrong, people just lie about the data. And they just put bad data in. What was happening there is they had performance goals, as Moneyball suggests, performance goals for wait times. But they were unable to meet the wait times, so they just said that they were. Okay? The British did this in their hospital system, where they had the Parliament said to them, hey, guys, look, you've got to see the patients, you know, within 3 hours of when they get in. Well, so what they started doing is if you put a patient on a gurney and put the patient in the hallway, that counted. Okay? That wasn't exactly seeing the patient, but it was getting them out of the chair in the waiting room and putting them on a gurney, and they started counting that until somebody figured it out. So there's no, in the end, no matter how much data we have, there's no replacement for kind of good old-fashioned ear to the ground, you know, talking to people and figuring out what the story is here. But yes, those are three good ideas. Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Listen, the Internal Revenue Service some years ago had what everybody thought was a great incentive system, which is agents would get rewarded on the number of cases they closed, right? Well, what that meant in practice was that if you had some widow, some old lady whose husband had been cheating on his taxes for 10 years, the IRS agents went and browbeat her into settling. If you had a mid-sized company that was not paying taxes and had lawyers to fight you, et cetera, they kind of left you alone because they wanted to make their numbers. And, of course, Congress got on this because Congress started getting all these complaints from people who felt truly victimized and really kind of were victimized. And so you're right. The measuring business, which we all love and we can do because we have computers and we have data, et cetera, is really a tricky business.
Okay, I want to add a fourth book, which is The Red Team, which deals with what could go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And in the book, it talks about what we've all heard about and don't know the history of is the devil's advocate,
mm-hmm.
which comes from the Catholic Church and putting people forward for sainthood. And there was an obligation to argue against these people, because if you could find an argument against them, maybe they weren't good enough to be saints. And I understand Christopher Hitchens argued against St. Teresa. Sister yes, Teresa at the time. But anyway, that seems like a very good approach, is to say immediately ask what could go wrong.
Mm-hmm. And that is a good approach. And there's, particularly in the area of terrorism, that is encouraged, okay? And they are constantly red teaming at TSA, okay? They're getting things through or trying to get things through. They're red teaming all the time about terrorist approaches, et cetera. The places where you need red teaming most and are also expensive to do. And so what happens is they get dropped, you know, when budgets are tight, et cetera. It's like training money, you know. It's sort of the first thing to go. So you're absolutely right, and it should be done more of. And it always kind of gets short shrift in organizations that need to be doing it.
In the last, I think, 2 years of the Obama administration, you've seen a Republican leadership focused explicitly on making sure that nothing he wants to pass will pass, mm-hmm. and even expressly stating that as a goal. What's your kind of feeling about the future and how that kind of thing can be stopped? Is that a matter of personal skills, or is that a matter of democracy is finally starting to come to an end as we know it?
that's a dramatic question, isn't it? I do not think, I mean, I'm a fan of President Obama. Of course, I voted for him, but I really don't think he was very good at that part of the job. I think it was actually, that was the part of the job he was worst at. I mean, the fact that you don't have a drink or play golf with the Speaker of the House till you're, you know, 6 years into your government or whatever it was, that's pretty awful. Okay, he just didn't have the feel for that kind of politics. Think back to Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan. Okay, you couldn't imagine two more different people in terms of their politics. But, you know, they were great buddies. They passed the 1983 Social Security Reform Act, which extended Social Security for some more years. We need to do another 1983 Act soon. It can be done. So there is an element of personal skill. I also think there's a leadership problem in the Republican Party. They had the tail wagging the dog in that Republican caucus. You know, how many people were in the Tea Party caucus out of 200 and some Republicans? 64. There were some bomb throwers, right? There always are in the Congress. There weren't a heck of a lot of them. And yet Speaker Boehner in particular seemed unable to stand up to them. Now, a little bit of this has to do with reforms, all right? This is the flip side of reform or the downside of reform. When you get rid of pork, when you get rid of wasteful spending, you have nothing to make a deal with. Okay, you used to be able to peel off a couple people from the opposition because they wanted a new library or they wanted this or they wanted that. You get rid of pork, you got nothing. When you weaken political parties, which everybody thought was a great idea, right, you actually open the door for dark money to come into campaigns. And dark money comes in via these ideological billionaires who put the money in all sorts of funny places, and suddenly members of Congress are worried about being primaried by people. So a lot of this has to do with things that we have done to ourselves, ironically, in the name of democracy. And, of course, there's a scholar who works with me at Brookings named John Rausch who basically has said that you have to roll back some of these democratic reforms in order to save democracy. It is a complicated argument, but it does go to how Congress works and how it has not been working.
Next question.
One of the concerns I've had for many years has to do with the number of bureaucracies that have the full force of law but are not elected legislatures. The EPA is one. Mm-hmm. And the Inland Waters Act, I know you're familiar with that. And up until Memorial Day, if the EPA said you can't use this land because it could have an impact on inland waters, mm-hmm. no matter where those inland waters were, the citizen had no redress, couldn't sue, couldn't stop. Now, fortunately, the Supreme Court said, yes, you can sue, and that was issued Memorial Day. But they'd been in existence for 40 years before that came down. How many other government agencies exist over which we have no control and no redress? And do you ever see any change being made there? Because there is no accountability in government. People can do what they will and get away with it. So do you ever see a change
in that? Well, the change happens when Congress exercises oversight over the executive branch. And Congress has gotten out of the business of oversight in the last several decades. So those are the sorts of things that ought to be fixed by the relevant committee saying, and Gene knows this process very well, by the relevant committee saying, this is not right. You need to change this. We're going to cut your appropriations. You need a change in the law. We're going to change the law. Okay? And what's happened as Congress has gotten more polarized is that they spend an awful lot of time fundraising. They spend an awful lot of time grandstanding against each other, and they don't do oversight. I maintain that the executive branch is actually getting quite powerful because of this, but not because they're assuming power. It's because there's a vacuum, and Congress let them. Congress is just not in the business of doing oversight anymore. And until they get back, so, you know, this book was about getting the government, the president, back into government. Well, the same thing needs to be said for Congress. They need to get back into the business of government. And until they do, you're not going to have this. I mean, one of the reasons that, you know, when I think of good agencies and bad agencies in the government, ones that are functioning and people like, the Social Security Administration has always been a wonderfully run agency. Why? Because so many Americans care about it. So many Americans or their grandparents get Social Security. And the slightest little thing goes wrong. Your check is a day late, something screws up, and bam, where do they go? To the congressional office. And the congressional office is on the Social Security Administration, et cetera. The congressional offices need to do this on more parts of the government than Social Security. And they haven't been. I mean, that's just the bottom line.
How will the next presidents fail? What are the two two possibilities with the coming candidate?
That's a really good question. I think that the next presidents, I think whoever gets elected is going to do infrastructure. Okay? I think Trump would do it. I know Hillary will do it. So an infrastructure project involving billions and billions of dollars could be very successful, and it could be a total disaster, right? It could build bridges to nowhere. Okay, it could be a real mess. So that's one of those areas where the structure and the implementation is going to make all the difference, right? If you do an infrastructure project and somehow it doesn't create jobs, which is a big piece of this, that's going to be a failure, right? So I think there's a lot of ways they can fail. I think the second way is on how they treat Wall Street. Both candidates have railed against Wall Street, whether it's carried interest deduction or, you know, whatever. And while I think a lot of that is true, the fact is you don't want to be throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Right. So you can see making mistakes there, and you can see an SEC that gets too aggressive, right? And starts then impeding growth and impeding innovation. So I think there's a lot of issues down the pike. And then, of course, there's all the messes all over the world. Right. And how the United States how the next president decides to, for instance, deal with Syria. And no-fly zones or not no-fly zones or whatever they decide to do. So I think there's plenty of landmines out there for the next president. Oh, there's somebody in the back, a young man.
Hey, just a quick question. We talk about committees and oversight. You know, the last prominent oversight committees I can think of in the last 5-6 years were largely kind of declared partisan. It's like the Benghazi committee, the IRS investigations, mm-hmm, the mm-hmm. Holder investigations. Do you think that's possible to re-legitimize investigative oversight from Congress, just since most of the high-profile committees have been, by one side or the other, decried as partisan exercises?
Say the last piece again.
Do you think that it's damaged the legitimacy of oversight in Congress?
Oh, because they've been so partisan?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Congress is always engaged in two kinds of oversight, right? And the political scientists call the Benghazi kind of thing fire alarm oversight, right? Uh-oh, something happens. Something bad happens, and Congress calls a committee, and they, you know, take it apart piece by piece. The other kind of oversight is they call police patrol oversight, okay? Much less sensational, much calmer, right? That's where you are taking an executive branch, you're calling them up, you're talking to them in a non-sensational and usually nonpartisan way. Congress used to do a lot more police patrol. And they always did. They always did the fire alarm stuff because, let's face it, that gets you on cameras. That's good politics, et cetera. But it's the absence of the other kind of oversight that leads you to problems, that leads you to a Veterans Administration that doesn't treat veterans and all the other problems that I talk about in the book. So it's that kind of oversight that I think has been missing in recent years, and that has to do with an awful lot of things that are going wrong with Congress. But that's maybe a next book.
I had a colleague that was given the job of Inspector General at the State Department, and he lost it a couple of years later in a political brouhaha. And I was just wondering, the Inspector Generals, almost all the departments have an Inspector General. Aren't they supposed to sort of do this police patrol kind of work?
They are, and some of them do a really good job. And one of the reasons we know so much about what's working and what's not working in the government are the inspectors general and the Government Accountability Office. Those are the two entities that are, and sort of the Library of Congress as well, the Congressional Research Service. They are constantly unearthing this stuff and constantly looking at them. But there's so much of it that it gets lost. And when it blows up, you know, the 10 scholars over there say, well, we kept telling you that, mm-hmm. right? We kept telling you it was going to blow up. So the management trick, and it's a management trick, is to figure out how to effectively understand that in a way that the president can not go fix it himself, right, himself or herself, they're not going to go do that, but can direct their government in such a way that these problems get identified and get fixed before they blow up in their faces.
You said you worked for the Clinton administration, right, for 5 years. What did you do, and is this where you got your perspective on government and how it needs to
Yeah, be implemented? I ran a little program, was actually a big program, called Reinventing Government. Mm-hmm. And we conducted the first major reform effort of the federal government since the Brownlow Commission in the 1930s. And we kept it going for 8 years. And in that time, we looked not just to save money, although that was sometimes important, but we really looked at operations. We looked at operational effectiveness, and we looked at, you know, who was doing good and who wasn't. I was at Stanford yesterday, and one of the professors there said, you know, we've spent so much time, even in graduate schools, teaching policy analysis, we've forgotten about implementation. So it's something that's happening all across the board. And implementation is just operations, right? How does it work? I mean, every business has that. There's business schools have a big science of this as well. And so I think we need to get back to operations. I saw a lot of that in the federal government, and I saw every piece of the federal government. And while it is large, it is sort of overwhelming, it isn't impossible. It isn't impossible to figure out.
No, but it is, there are. Okay, yeah, I'll give you the question here.
excuse me. Yes, I am intrigued by your mention of a staff to scan the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, likely, how many people is a good number for this? And can you say more exactly, more about what they would do? How would they go about this?
Well, the executive office of the president is about 1,000 people, has been for some years now, okay? The executive office of the president, when Lincoln was president, was 2 people. And so now it's 1,000 people, which doesn't count the National Security Council and Office of Management and Budget, which are also kind of related there. And of that 1,000 or so people, there's an awful lot of people engaged in advance work, speech writing, et cetera. I would say that what I say in the book is if the president upgraded the Office of Cabinet Affairs, used his cabinet less for message purposes, more for keeping track of what's happening in their agencies, and if there was a stronger Office of Cabinet Affairs. You know, at one point, I quote somebody in the book as saying that the Office of Cabinet Affairs was reduced to a young woman in a telephone booth. Okay, that was all. And you know, that person never got in. I actually know that person, and she never got in to see the president. So it's an upgrading. It really is an upgrading of that function. What it would take, you could do it with 10 people. Okay, you could do with 10 people, particularly because, remember, you have 10 people talking to cabinet secretaries, assistant secretaries. Every agency has think of it as a cloud over it, of people who understand it. So you have the person at the Office of Management and Budget, which knows everything about their budgets and where their money is. And you have somebody at the General Government Accountability Office who's done many, many reports on that agency. You have outside academics who study it. You have interest groups. I mean, you know, these bad old lobbyists, okay? Well, the reason lobbyists don't go away is they know stuff, right? And you need to know. I mean, one of the problems in sort of banning lobbyists is they actually know stuff that people need to know, like what the effect of this will be on some set of companies in the private sector, right? If you do this, they will do that. Think of it as a sort of take every agency, and remember many of these government agencies are the size of a Fortune 500 or Fortune 100 company. Around each one is a set of talent and information. And it is possible to understand that and get a general view of A, what's going wrong, and B, what kind of person you need to put in charge of it. Because, of course, that's the other thing. The simple story is the Internal Revenue Service in the Clinton administration, the first director of the Internal Revenue Service was a tax lawyer. Tax lawyers had been the directors of the IRS forever. But guess what? The IRS doesn't make tax policy. Tax policy is made by the Assistant Secretary of Tax at Treasury. The IRS is the world's biggest, most complicated information technology system. It's taking in millions of returns and processing them, right? And then sending out money or dunning people for more money or, you know, whatever, right? That is a complicated information technology challenge. And one of the things we did was we put in as the IRS commissioner the first ever non-tax attorney. We took a great guy, Charles Rosati, who had founded a software company and who was rich enough and public-spirited enough to go into the government. And he went into the government. And when we brought him in, the IRS had wasted $4 billion in unsuccessful modernization contracts because nobody knew enough to even manage the contracts. And Rosati turned it around. And so you're not going to have, you know, one of the lessons you learn is no more tax attorneys. You want IT people. Look at the Veterans Administration. Until recently, we always had generals running the VA. Now, generals know how to fight wars. The Veterans Administration is a gigantic healthcare operation. Okay, they run huge numbers of hospitals. The biggest port piece of VA is healthcare. You don't want a general there. You want somebody who has run a massive hospital system, a massive health insurance system, something like that. The VA is first and foremost a healthcare operation. Does a couple other things along the way, but most of its money, most of its people are devoted to healthcare. So these are the sort of insights you get when you start looking at operations, right? So part of this is picking the right kind of people to head these agencies. And one final piece is that in every single one of these agencies, there are career executives who spent 20 to 30 years there. They know everything. If you don't listen to them, you're in trouble. If you do listen to them, you can probably move the ball forward a little bit and prevent trouble. And that relationship is always difficult between the political people and the career people in the agencies.
And the career people in the agencies who have been there a long time and know what they want usually get it eventually.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, because they know they can just outwait the president. They've done it before, and if they want to, they will do it again.
I did a deal for when the savings and loan crisis took place in the late 80s, and the FSLIC, which was the company that was regulating all of the savings and loan, was considered a total failure, and so they put in the Resolution Trust Corporation, and the Resolution Trust Corporation took over. While I was there doing that, we found out that the whole point of the Resolution Trust Corporation was that the FSLIC had been trying for 20 years to get a new office building and had failed to ever talk anybody. They had a lousy office building, and they knew that with a new name and a new thing. And so the new name, they got a brand new building, and then they hired everybody back over to the other one.
I love it.
That's how it worked. Anyway, thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Do you want me to?
It's just a great insight into how things actually happen. And so ends another event in the 114th year of Enlightened Discussion at the Commonwealth Club. Thank you very much.